The whole family.
The whole family. I went to Withington Girls' School, but less said about that, the better. I worked.
Have you ever been to the Red Lion?
I drank in the Red Lion when Greg was pulling the pint. I would probably have met Debbie and Greg.
Oh, well, I'll tell you what, let's split it three ways. You could all have it. You could all be the MMP. That's me done now. Tony and Jeanette are coming up with Drive.
This is 5 Live Drive.
Matt, thank you very much indeed. Hello, everyone. It is Drive on 5 Live. Tony and Jeanette with you. Let's start with the headlines as we always do at 4 o'clock. Mohammed Al-Fayed has been described as a monster and a predator by lawyers representing 37 of the women who've accused him of rape and sexual assault. They're pursuing a civil case against Harrods, saying it enabled its former owner's behaviour. Paul Connew worked at the News of the World when the paper investigated Mr Al-Fayed in the late 1980s.
We found, I think, about three Harrods employees, a couple of whom were absolutely too scared to even talk to us, but one who did tell us all about it, but strictly off the record, unwilling to in any way go into print, because, as she put it, women there were terrified.
Harrods insists the company is very different now and a process is available to women who say they were attacked by Mr Al-Fayed. He also owned Fulham Football Club between 1997 and 2013. It's investigating whether any women were abused there. Officials in Lebanon say at least eight people have died in an Israeli strike on the capital Beirut, and there are reports a senior Hezbollah commander was killed. Earlier, the militant group fired more than 100 rockets into Israel. Lebanon's ambassador to the UK, Rami Mortada, told 5 Live they want a peaceful solution.
We will not stand idly when our territories are attacked. We hope we don't get into an all-out war. We still believe that diplomacy and wisdom can prevail. And there are extensive efforts being deployed to defuse the situation, but it needs a positive response from the other side.
People with peanut allergies are being urged to avoid foods containing mustard and mustard powder. The Food Standards Agency says peanuts have contaminated mustard products made by an Indian company called GT Agro Industries. It's trying to work out which products have been affected. The deputy leader of Reform UK says its ambition is to win the next general election. Richard Tice has been speaking at the party's annual conference as it gets underway in Birmingham and says it has big plans.
We're focusing now on the May elections next year, really important county elections, unitary elections, mayoral elections, with a plan to build confidence, build enthusiasm, build professionalism. Our plan is to win the next general election and to save Britain. It's as simple as that.
And Sky says anyone having problems with its Sky Glass tellies or streaming services should head to its website for instructions on a manual reset. People have been reporting problems since last night. Some of the TVs wouldn't even switch on. Jeanette's here. Hello, Jeanette.
Hello, Tony. Hello. How are you
just
doing?
Talking to Sky reminded me of back in my days on Northwest Tonight when I was a football reporter.
Forget about your
and,
past.
A manager at one of the Northwest clubs said to us one day, I'll speak to the press, but I'm not speaking to Sky. And we thought, whoa, what's happened
what
here?
What
have they said about him? And it turned out that they'd not been round to amend his dish.
That's the reason why. Yeah.
Actually, I thought it was a good story. Shoujo's here with the sport. Shoujo, hello.
Good afternoon. Surrey's cricketers have etched their names in immortality after winning the county championship for 3 years in a row. They are the first team to achieve that feat since Yorkshire in the 1960s. Surrey were confirmed as the champions earlier today after title rivals Somerset lost away at Lancashire. English golfer Matthew Baldwin is in the clubhouse at 13 under par. That's after a second round at the PGA Championship at Wentworth. He carded a 66 today to back up his 65 yesterday. So at 13 under, Baldwin is currently 3 shots clear at the top of the leaderboard. And the F1 team McLaren will modify the rear wing they used to win the Azerbaijan Grand Prix last weekend after rivals raised questions about its legality. Governing body, the FIA, had initially said the wing did not require any changes but has now changed its stance. On the track, McLaren driver Lando Norris was quickest in second practice at the Singapore Grand Prix.
In the latest travel news, on the roads, Bedfordshire, the M1 southbound is partially blocked between Junction 12 at Flitwick and 11A at the moment because of a broken down vehicle. You have got queuing traffic, so it's looking fairly slow. The M40 northbound is partially blocked between Junction 10 at Brackley to 11 at Banbury at the moment. There's been an accident. Again, very slow moving traffic because of that. Essex, the M11 southbound, partially blocked again. There's an obstruction on the road at Junction 6 at the M25 interchange. Traffic is getting through, but it's crawling along there. The M25 clockwise, one lane is closed between the Wisley Interchange at Junction 10 and 11. Congestion there is back to Junction 9. It's a broken down vehicle, but because it's in the roadworks area, it's making it particularly slow. And in Surrey, the M23 southbound, all traffic is being held between the M25 Interchange at Junction 8 and 9 at Gatwick Airport. So stationary traffic currently. Ellie Brennan, Five Live Travel.
Ellie, thank you very much indeed. So official hello to everybody. Official hello to you. Oh, I said an official, yeah, a semi-official hello.
Yeah.
All right, you okay?
Good evening or good afternoon,
good
everybody.
Good evening. Yes. Are you all right?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm all right, yeah, good.
Okay, good. It's Friday.
We're both
feeling
all right.
Good. Everything's we're both
fine.
Good.
High five in loads to get through.
Loads to get through. Can I just say, I am looking forward to your Lennox Lewis interview later on in the show today.
Yes.
You've really talked it up, so now we're going to have to sit back and listen. It should be a masterpiece.
Well, you say that. If you were listening yesterday, I had to interview Lennox Lewis while Steve Bunce, the legend, stood by and listened. So, three questions in, I was really struggling to with my boxing. That was a dragging question. Yeah, what's your favourite colour, Lennox? Anyway, we're going to play it out later on, so we shall play. Something I'm looking forward to as well. Some old friends, you know, I don't know if you've been on the show when we've interviewed them, but Alison and Frank, when we talk about dementia, we've spoken to them quite a lot, and they're lovely people. And today is National Playlist Day, which celebrates playing music to unlock people's memories from the past. Well proven to work with people suffering from dementia, that suddenly they can be transported back in their lives. And we're going to play, we've got Frank's favourite song.
Oh.
So we're going to play it to him.
Okay.
Later in the show. So I'm looking forward to that.
It's a playlist, National Playlist Day.
Yeah. And if anyone wants to say, tell us why a song means something special to them as well, we might see if we can find the time.
Please, anything for a bit of music on the show, it's always nice.
On a Friday, we like that. 85058. Also, there's a programme on BBC One tonight about a married couple who've taken to renovating, doing up a massive stately home in Rotherham.
I saw this.
They spend a lot of time in there working away. Rosemary, they're married, Rosemary and Dave. Rosemary says she's known as Classy Scrubber, because that's her job. That's her name, not mine. And Dave is known as Brasso Dave, because he brassos things to within an inch of their life. Anything, don't move, you're brassoed.
So they've taken on this project together.
Yeah, it's great.
I mean, it feels like a good idea at the time, doesn't it? It's not.
Three times the size of Buckingham Palace.
Oof.
So when you start brassoing, that's a lot of brassoing. On that note, has anyone ever been given a nickname because of the job they do? So let's have your work nicknames. 85058.
Keep it clean. Keep it clean.
Yeah, so it's Wittering Tony and Olympic Jeanette.
That's nice.
That'll do it here on Five Live. Yeah, keep it clean. your nicknames work related. 85058. WhatsApp is 0808599693. Loads to get through. It's Friday on Drive. It's 4:07.
On Radio 4. The more you listen, the more you see.
We're living under more tyranny today than our founding fathers did in 1775.
A US presidential election is looming, but underneath, conspiracy culture rears its head once again. And nothing is as it seems.
All those things that we had feared our whole lives was coming true.
Burn the house down and start over. That seems to be the way.
It's America through the looking glass. Join me, Gabriel Gatehouse, as The Coming Storm continues. Listen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
The voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Drive.
It is Five Live Drive with Tony Livesey and Jeanette Kouachi. Now, lawyers representing some of the women who've come forward to accuse Mohamed Al-Fayed say that 37 are now making allegations of abuse. It's after five women told a BBC investigation they'd been raped by the former Harrods boss when they worked at the luxury London department store.
Yes, the legal team are seeking justice for the women involved and are looking to the current owners of Harrods to play their part in that. They presented their case at a press conference this morning at the King's Counsel Dean... And the King's Counsel, Dean Armstrong, couldn't have put things more bluntly.
We will say it plainly. Mohamed Al-Fayed was a monster. He was a monster. But he was a monster enabled by a system. A system that pervaded Harrods. Those of you who have seen the most magnificent documentary that we saw last night will know and may well remember very clearly the words of the manager who said the following. Anyone who tells you they didn't know what was going on is lying.
Mr. Armstrong said it was clear the abuse had gone on for decades and that many people within Harrods had known what was happening.
Our aim, and our single aim, is to seek justice for the survivors of the sexual abuses of Mohammed El-Fayed, who we say was enabled by an unsafe system of work which Harrods established, maintained, certainly acquiesced to, and we say facilitated during his chairmanship. We believe that the system not only enabled, but potentially and allowed to a knowing extent the widespread sexual abuse of the survivors that we represent. I have many years of practice, and I have never seen a case as horrific as this. This case combines some of the most horrific elements of the cases involving Jimmy Savile, Jeffrey Epstein, and Harvey Weinstein. Savile, because in this case, as in that, the institution, we say, knew about the behaviour. Epstein, because in that case, as in this, there was a procurement system in place to source the women and girls, as you know, there are some very young victims of this, for abuse. And Weinstein, because it was a person at the very top of the organisation who was abusing his power.
Well, that is the voice of Dean Armstrong, KC. Also speaking at the same press conference was one of the survivors, Natasha. She was 19 when she started working for Mohammed El-Fayed. Now, I'll just give you a 10 or 15 seconds notice here. We're about to play 2 minutes of audio of what she said. It is very distressing. So if you just want to turn it down, maybe you're on the school run, I'll give you another few seconds just to reach for the radio. It's 2 minutes long, so you know it's safe perhaps after that to turn your radio back up. Okay, here's the voice then from the press conference today of Natasha.
I was subjected to an unnecessary and intrusive medical examination. I was never given those results. I was subjected to AIDS and STD testing without consent, and now believe in hindsight, I was checked for my purity. We would be sent to see El-Fayed because he had a job for us to do. It was always more of a friendly chat than actual work. But then these private meetings turned into more. A forced kiss. His hands gripping your face to his lips or pulling you down on his lap where his hands were free to explore any part of your body that he wished. He summoned me up to his private apartment on the pretext of a job review. I was escorted by one of his security guards who ushered me into his private sitting room. The door was locked behind me. El-Fayed handed me a glass of champagne and told me to sit. Looking around, I saw his bedroom door partially open. There were sex toys on view. I felt petrified. I perched myself at the very end of the sofa, and then it came. Mohammed El-Fayed, my boss, the person I work for, pushed himself onto me. I fell to the floor with him still on top of me, but I managed to kick free and free myself. I ran towards the door. I told him I was meeting my father for dinner and he would be worried that I was late. He just laughed at me. He then composed himself and he told me in no uncertain terms that I was never to breathe a word of this to anyone. If I did, I would never work in London again, and he knew where my family lived. I felt scared and sick. Eventually leaving Park Lane, I never set foot in his private office again.
So our correspondent, Asadeh Mashiri, was watching the news conference in London and spoke to me just a few minutes ago.
Well, we saw about 20 women who've come forward with their stories in that room when their lawyers detailed the civil case that they're bringing forward against Harrods. That is for their failure to provide a safe system of work for their employees. And they've said that this was possible partly because of the network that the BBC investigation exposed and the pattern it revealed of sexual abuse as well as predatory behaviour by Mohammed Al-Fayed. And it's worth remembering that the investigation also gathered evidence that Harrods not only failed to intervene at the time, but also helped cover up allegations of abuse. What the King's Counsel said at the press conference today is that while Harrods says they only learned about these claims in 2023, he called it a lie. Now, it's important to say that the current owners and Harrods say they're utterly appalled by the allegations, that they apologize to the victims, and that they've set up a process that can quickly settle claims for the women should they want to avoid a lengthy legal process. But this was coupled today, all this news, with some really difficult testimony from one of the victims, Natasha, who was at that podium. She said she joined Harrods when she was only 19 years old, that she was excited about her future, but didn't realize she was joining a lion's den. There was testimony about the medical examinations that Harrods put them through, information about their medical care that was shared with Mohammed Al-Fayed, and abuse, they say, that was consistent throughout that period of employment. Now, what we're waiting for is to see what happens next with this legal claim, because some of it's quite complicated in the sense that even though the ownership changed in 2010, Harrods as a legal entity still continued to exist. And therefore, even the current owners would be liable to respond to any claims of wrongdoing that would have taken place before they became the official owners.
You mentioned the King's Counsel that was speaking there today alongside the victim, Natasha, but Gloria Allred was also there, the US attorney, very famous for her support of women who have been through sexual abuse cases. What are the lawyers planning to do here?
Yes, Gloria Allred's presence really highlights the global nature of this, because this didn't just happen in London, according to these women. And more of them, by the way, are coming forward as a result of the investigation. It happened in Paris, Abu Dhabi, Saint-Tropez, according to them, because they were personal assistants to Mohammed Al-Fayed. One of them was an interior designer. And so they followed him not only in his different places of work, but also his homes. And that is where the sexual abuse, the assault, the rape, according to them, took place. So what the lawyers are now doing is taking forward individual claims. And to your point about what they're doing next, it isn't a simple task, because they could have moved forward, for example, with a class action lawsuit. That's when all of these potential victims would gather together and file a claim together. But they are saying that each of these cases is unique. The damages that these women have had to deal with in terms of their mental health, the damage to their careers, each story is unique to them, and that's why they're pursuing these cases individually.
Away from Harrods, Fulham Football Club, they're also urging women who worked at the club under Al-Fayed to come forward. Of course, Al-Fayed, the owner there from 1997 to 2013, when he sold it for 16 years. It's quite proactive from the club, isn't it?
It is. Jeanette, it's also a reminder of Mohammed Al-Fayed's storied career, a self-made billionaire who owns several businesses. Now, Fulham, as you say they're beginning an investigation into it. They say that they currently don't at this stage know of any specific cases. The lawyers working on the civil case today also said that they don't at this stage represent any women previously working for Fulham. But what the football club has said is that they're aware of allegations that other businesses owned by Mohammed Al-Fayed, and therefore they're deeply troubled, in their words, by the findings of the BBC investigation. And they've said that they're in the process right now of establishing whether anyone at the club is or has been affected, and they are calling out for anyone who would want to share either any information they know or experiences related to those allegations to contact the club or the police. That's also an appeal that's been made by the lawyers today, who are saying that if any potential victims need it, there's a community ready to support them.
And how did the police play a role in this as well? Because, of course, nearly 40 women are making a case against Mr. Al-Fayed, potentially more women to come. How will the police be involved with this?
Well, they've made that appeal, insisting that they want people to come forward should they have any information. You know, it's one of the hard truths of all of this, that these allegations aren't new. Some women did try to speak out. Some even filed claims and went to the police. There was even a Vanity Fair article that was published. It didn't outline any rape allegations, but it did outline sexual assault allegations. And the authors and the women were then sued for libel by Mohammed Al-Fayed at the time. So a lot of this has been going on for years. The key thing here is that these women say the fear they felt going up against a man as powerful as Mohammed Al-Fayed has disappeared, partly because he died at 94 years old, partly because there's strength in numbers. As you say, more women are coming forward, but also because they're upset. They saw his portrayal in the TV series The Crown as this gregarious, kind, affectionate man nicknamed Mumu, and that isn't what they remember. They want to set the record straight. And as one victim, Natasha, said as she stood at that podium in the press conference today, she said they don't feel the same fear because it's no longer a time where women feel they're the underclass of the working world.
Well, that's our correspondent there, Azadeh Mashiri. She's speaking to me after the news conference in London around Mohammed Al-Fayed. Now, if you have been affected by this story, there's details of organisations offering information and support available at bbc.co.uk/actionline, or you can call for free at any time to hear recorded information on 0800 066 066. You can watch Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods on BBC iPlayer now. You can also listen to World of Secrets Season 4, Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods, and that's on BBC Sounds. It's 21 minutes past four.
Yeah, it is. It's worth saying as well, we're going to have much more on that story later on in Drive. After five, we're going to talk to a professor about how men, it's often men in positions of power, can become a threat to women who work for them, and what can be done to tackle that risk. And after six, we're going to hear from a journalist who started investigating Mohammed Al-Fayed back in the 1990s.
In other news as well, serious developments in Lebanon today after the health ministry said that eight people had been killed and more than 50 injured in an airstrike on the capital city, Beirut. Now, it's thought that Israel had been targeting a senior Hezbollah commander. We'll bring you up to date with all of that just after 4:30.
Yeah, so as you would imagine, on Drive we have all the main news stories covered. There's other stuff knocking around as well. There's that big heavyweight fight this weekend, Anthony Joshua against Daniel Dubois. I haven't asked you who you want to win. Can you say?
Oh, it's a good fight. I come on the fence. I can't. That's terrible, isn't it? Sorry.
Okay. No, that's all right. You're just after a gig commentating at the next one. That's all you. That's at Wembley Stadium, 96,000. I've been getting the thoughts of Lennox Lewis on the fight. And that's after you heard this yesterday, if you were listening. But after I got the Steve Bunce seal of approval.
Lennox is a good guy from Tony. He's a really good guy.
Tony, I heard some good things about you.
I know, but I've heard Bunce there. Unless you are you working Bunce with your foot, Lennox? Well, I laughed anyway.
Do you know, I'm seeing Lennox Lewis on Monday, actually.
I didn't tell you.
So
ask him how good I was.
I didn't want to say, just, I have to say it now, you know.
Do you think he'll remember me? What are you seeing him for? I mean, unofficially or officially?
Well, it's official, but it's really exciting what I'm doing.
What are you doing?
I'll tell you later. I'll tell you once we get into the Lennox Lewis stuff, because it is quite exciting.
You can tell us on the show.
I can a little bit. Yeah, I can give a little bit away. Yeah. But anyway, you can hear what Lennox had to say after six. We'll also be looking ahead to the return of the WSL tonight. That's back with Chelsea playing their first game in their post-Emma Hayes era. And of course, no sporting weekend is really underway until we've got Fact of the Day. I've missed it.
Yeah.
I've been on with you. John Murray.
More controversy today, I'm afraid, with Fact of the Day, but a genuinely interesting fact. It's not often I can say that. Just very quickly before we move on, you know, we've got Brasso Dave coming on later on because he brassos everything. I just want to say hello to Dulux Des, who's Ozzy says that's his decorator. He's known as Dulux Des. So we're really looking for people who've got nicknames due to their hobbies. Rubber Jeff's been on from Hall Green. He makes rubber tyres for vintage motorcycles. So what's your hobby nickname? We'll give you a name check. Is that fair enough?
That's good.
Name dropper Jeanette. Right.
Name dropper Jeanette. Yeah. You were talking about Lennox Lewis. It felt relevant.
I interviewing him officially. You're going out for a
no, we're
intimate
not.
Supper or something.
No, what?
Well, you're going to tell us later what you're doing, aren't
you? I will.
Daily Mail, don't print that, for goodness sake.
No, please do not.
The story will be out later on. Good. Right. It is. Shall I say the time and move on?
Please.
4:24.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We need somebody to look after our economy.
It's the biggest issue in Scotland at the moment.
Wherever you are in the UK, you're part of this with us on this network. 5 Live Drive.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Now, the police watchdog, the IOPC, which is investigating police actions following the Hillsborough disaster, has apologised to bereaved families and survivors for causing them distress. Some of the letters that they've sent out have been described by campaigning groups as abhorrent, degrading and cruel. Hillsborough survivor Val Yates was one of the survivors who received an insensitive letter. She's told the BBC that it said there was no evidence to support her account of seeing bodies of the deceased on the day, and said that corrections made to her final police statement were uncontentious. She's very, very angry about this, and I spoke to Val just before we came on air.
I didn't expect it to be coming. I don't think anybody did. The complaint against the IOPC was made about the conduct of the police, and the complaint was made over 10 years ago. Literally, the letter came out of the blue, and it sort of didn't really say anything about the police conduct, other than that the complaint wasn't going to be upheld, and the letter was more a dissection of my original statement, which was taken 35 years ago now, and my evidence that I gave to the inquest in Warrington, it dissected it, and basically it trashed it. It trashed my whole experience, and they effectively told me that I was lying, that I wasn't remembering things correctly. It was a real stab in the heart, to be honest, because how dare they, trash our experiences. I know I wasn't the only survivor to get a letter like that. And essentially they were all the same. They were personalised to go through with a fine-tooth comb, things that had been said in our statements.
Yeah.
And they just rubbished it. They just trashed it. For example, they told me that there was no evidence that I'd seen a dead body. And I don't know why they brought that into it, because there's not anybody there who wouldn't have seen a dead body, because they were scattered all over the pitch. They were in the pens. I was helping carry balls. So absolutely, I saw a dead body. I saw plenty of dead bodies. And to tell me that I didn't see that, that it was one of the most traumatic things I've seen in my entire life. And to tell me that I didn't see it, because there's no evidence to support it, it's just like rubbishing, my experiences. Another thing they did was they fabricated more evidence, and they said that I was treated by two St John's ambulance people because I was in absolute hysterics. And that is just a complete and utter lie. Now, what that had to do with the complaint about the conduct of the police is beyond me. That's going through people's experiences of Hillsborough, that was never in the remit. The remit was to look at the conduct of the police, not my evidence or my statements or my experience at Hillsborough. And to get the letter like that, to just slash everything, it was traumatic. It took me right back to being at Hillsborough, and made me feel once again that we were being blamed and, branded murderers all over again. I didn't think it was fair. I didn't think it was right. And I think it's an insult to the families, the survivors, and also an insult to the jurors who returned the verdict of unlawful killing, and that the Liverpool fans were in no way to blame. And this IOPC letter that we got gave, just rubbished all of that.
Why do you think this has happened now?
Because it's just another part. It's just another establishment cover up, isn't it? That they're supposed to be impartial and look at evidence and what have you, but they haven't done that. They're not impartial. You cannot have police investigating police and be impartial. Nobody's ever faced proper accountability for what happened at Hillsborough. Those in authority, that's why people campaign for a Hillsborough law, because those in authority never seem to face accountability for mistakes they've made when they've been negligent and so on. And in the instance of the cover-up with Hillsborough, it was outright corruption because they altered statements, you know, police altered statements, and they weren't obliged to tell the truth. You know, they actively fabricated evidence to lay the blame squarely at the door of the victims and the survivors.
It feels like
this is going down the same road.
Val, where does this put you, the fact that you've said this letter makes you feel doubted now about your own experience, where does that put you mentally?
Well, not in a good place, because, like, I'm not from Liverpool. Obviously, I live not too far from Sheffield. And, like, 35 years ago, when I came back home that night, and in the immediate aftermath and so on and so forth, all the help and the attention and everything was on people from Liverpool, and rightly so. But Liverpool's got a big fan base. You know, there were people from all over the country there, and I felt quite alone and isolated and, you know, unable to speak to anybody, to get any help. And because of the narrative that a certain gutter rag of a newspaper produced on their front page headline, people believed that. So, you know, it was like I was one of those people that had robbed the dead and so on and so forth. You know, the way the narrative was taken, it's traumatic. I was actually diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder in about 1990. So in the end, I didn't speak about Hillsborough for 20 years.
So, Val, I mean, you're in this position now, you've had this letter. What do you plan to do? Because I've got a copy of it here, I can see little bits of it where they're essentially saying you've no evidence to support some of the things you've said. Are you going to appeal this? Are you going to take them
on? We've got no right of appeal. The letter actually says we've got no right of reply. What I did was I spoke to a friend of mine, Charlotte Hennessy. I've known her 15-odd years, maybe longer, and she lost her dad, James Hennessy, at Hillsborough. She was only 6 when she lost her dad, and I spoke to her about it, saying, you know, how dare they write something like this to me. I mean, there's my scrawl all over that letter where I've sort of exploded in a fit of rage and wrote things in response. But we've got no right of reply as survivors. So Charlotte fired an email off to the IOPC and said, you know, how can you send stuff out like that without thinking about the impact that you've had on the mental health and the trauma that you'll cause, especially because you're rubbishing their evidence and their experience from 35 years ago. You know, it's an experience that we all live with every single day. None of us can forget it because it's so deeply traumatised and ingrained. So she fired an email off to them, and then they've sort of come up with this second letter saying, oh, well, you know, we're going to think about how we send it. We're going to send you 7 days' notice. And effectively, they're still calling you a liar, but they're going to say it in a nicer way, is the gist of the second letter.
Val, if that's correct, you've no right to reply. I mean, we'll catch up later with how this develops, but you're not the only survivor, I think, who's received these letters. So, listen, I appreciate, particularly after what you've been through and you had issues, I know, with PTSD, I really appreciate you taking us back to that time. So thanks very much for your time today.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you very much.
That's the voice of Val Yates, one of many, has to be said, Hillsborough survivors angry with the police watchdog over the way they've been dealt with. The IOPC has written to families and survivors to say it's sorry for any distress called. They've reviewed the letters that they're sending out. And the language in some of those letters, says the IOPC, has been changed. But the process of sending them will resume, though those to receive them will be given 10 days' notice so that they can access support if needed, and the process should be ended by autumn, but they don't know when their final report is out. So that's the latest there. Right, it's Drive with Tony and Jeanette. Let's get the news and sport headlines, shall we? 4:33.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
And the headlines, lawyers for some of the 37 women who accused Mohamed Al-Fayed of rape and sexual assault say Harrods enabled its former owner. The billionaire who died last year has been described as a monster and a predator. Harrods says it's a very different company now. Lebanese officials say Israel has carried out an airstrike on Hezbollah's stronghold in the capital, Beirut. The Israeli military says it was a targeted strike. Lebanon's ambassador to the UK, Rami Murtada, has told Five Live they're still hoping for a peaceful solution. The police watchdog has apologised for what have been described as an abhorrent, degrading and cruel letters it sent to bereaved families and survivors of the Hillsborough disaster. The IOPC says it's extremely sorry for any distress the letters had caused. And public debt as a share of the UK economy has hit 100% for the first time since the 1960s. The government borrowed £13.7 billion last month, £3 billion more than in August last year. Those are your heads, and Shoja's got your sport for you.
Thank you. The champagne corks are popping at the Oval today after Surrey secured cricket's county championship for the third successive season. It is the first time that any side has achieved that feat since Yorkshire in the 1960s. Their achievement was confirmed after their nearest challengers, Somerset, were beaten by Lancashire at Old Trafford. Well, the Surrey head coach, Gareth Batty, says in a crowded cricketing calendar, the county championship still deserves to be celebrated.
We have the best domestic structure in the world, and we've got to stop slating it and get behind it, because there's some wonderful cricket players, there's some wonderful people involved, and I think we need to champion it and keep moving it forward.
Englishman Matthew Baldwin is the golfer to catch at the top of the leaderboard at the PGA Championship at Wentworth. He followed up his 65 yesterday with a 66 today to be the clear clubhouse leader after his second round. He didn't even mind sleeping on a lead.
It was nice. Yeah, it was nice. It doesn't happen very often, so you've got to enjoy it while you can.
Well, he's certainly enjoying himself. Let's get to Wentworth, where our golf correspondent Ian Carter is watching the second round unfold.
Yes, he has a two-stroke lead from Nicholas Norgaard, who's just holed a short-range putt for eagle at the 12th, the winner of the British Masters, 11 under par, two shots behind Baldwin, the 38-year-old from Southport. Another Southport player doing extremely well is Tommy Fleetwood, who was round in 68 today at 7 under par. He's in a share of fifth place, but for Rory McIlroy, a little bit of disappointment. He birdied the 4th and the 6th, but then dropped a shot at the 8th. It's been par golf thereafter, and he's in the group at 6 under par.
Thank you, Ian. Most Premier League managers have been asked about the ever-increasing football schedule at the today, about the top end of the game. Manchester City midfielder Rodri and the Liverpool goalkeeper Alisson were among the high-profile players this week to flag up the increasing workloads. Rodri even suggested that a player strike could be a possibility. Well, the Chelsea boss Enzo Maresca does not mind players expressing their opinions on the issue.
In terms of games, it's too much. I don't think we protect players, but the only ones that they can do something are the players, because we can say what we think. That for me, it's completely wrong with the amount of games that we have. I think in the last two weeks, some of the players, they try to explain or to say what they think, and I think it's a good starting point.
The Women's Super League season gets underway tonight with defending champions Chelsea hosting Aston Villa. It will be the first WSL match in charge for the new Chelsea head coach, Sonia Bonpastor.
I think if you look at Aston Villa results, they had a really good pre-season with good results. But we just feel like we have been working really hard, and we feel ready for that, especially because it's a home game.
Also starting today is Rugby Union's new Premiership season. Among the first two matches tonight will be Bath versus Northampton at the Rec. That's a repeat of last season's final. And McLaren's Lando Norris was quickest in second practice at the Singapore Grand Prix, with Ferrari's Charles Leclerc close behind him. Red Bull's championship leader Max Verstappen, though, could only lap 15th fastest in that session.
In the latest travel news, on the roads in Bristol, the M5 southbound, one lane is closed because of flooding between junction 19 at Portishead and Clevedon at 20. So you have got some queuing traffic there, slower than usual. Essex, the M11 southbound, is partially blocked because of an obstruction on the road at junction 6, the M25 interchange. The M25 itself, couple of problems this evening. Clockwise, there's an accident earlier on between junction 24 at Potters Bar and 25. Congestion there is back to 22 at St Albans. All lanes are now back open, but it's in the roadworks area, so still looking slow. And clockwise, again, a broken down vehicle between Junction 10 at the Wisley Interchange and Junction 11 is meaning it's really busy back to Junction 9 around Leatherhead. That has now been moved from the main carriageway, so all lanes back open there, but again, in the roadworks area, so it's looking pretty busy still. Ellie Brennan, 5 Live Travel.
5 Live Premier League Sunday.
Mikel Arteta to Arsenal is confirmed.
We were sad when he leaves. He's a ball for beyond a good manager.
Arsenal have confirmed the signing of Declan Rice.
Manchester City have agreed a deal to sign Erling Haaland.
Champions again. They've won it 4 years running.
I think Arsenal will get even closer again.
Their level is higher and higher.
5 Live Premier League Sunday.
Welcome to you, Manchester City against Arsenal.
Listen, Sunday from 12 on 5 Live and BBC Sounds.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
Yeah, John Murray, whose voice you heard there, will join us later on in Drive. We'll look ahead to that game. And also Lennox Lewis will join us on the programme too. Before that, though, it's a really busy news afternoon here on 5 Live. The Israeli military says it's carried out a targeted strike on the Lebanese capital, Beirut, after Hezbollah fired more than 100 rockets into Israel. Reports from a number of news agencies say a senior Hezbollah commander, Ibrahim Akil, has been killed in the strike. He was reportedly killed alongside members of Hezbollah's elite Radwan unit as they were holding a meeting. Several others are thought to have been injured. Our correspondent Hugo Bechega sent us this report close to the blast site in a suburb of Beirut.
So we are here in Dahir, which is Beirut's southern suburb that is a stronghold of Hezbollah. We're not really far from the location that was hit in this Israeli airstrike. It is a very tense situation. I've got to tell you that we can't really move here because of we've been told by Hezbollah supporters, Hezbollah members, that we need to sort of stay here. But to my right, a few blocks from here, is the building where that was targeted in this Israeli airstrike. It happened at around 4 o'clock in the afternoon here. And you can see that this is a densely populated area of Beirut. So this happened in the middle of the afternoon. And now we know that there is a search operation. People are reported to be under the rubble. We've seen that there's some destruction there, at least one building that's partially collapsed. At least, you know, the facade of the building has collapsed as a result of this airstrike. And now the Lebanese authorities are saying that at least three people have been killed.
Lebanon's ambassador to the UK, Rami Mortada, has been speaking to Matt Chorley here on 5 Live.
You can imagine when there is a strike in a heavily populated area in the suburbs of Beirut, and the Israelis called it a targeted strike. This is very cynical. It's targeted to an extent that three children have been slaughtered. That's the initial toll, and eight have been killed and many more injured. So you can imagine the panic and the disarray that is prevailing today in Beirut city and its surrounding as across the Lebanese territory. Last night was very violent in terms of Israeli strikes throughout Lebanese territory, mainly in South Lebanon. We've been trying to avoid an all-out war for a year now, exerting diplomatic efforts in order to defuse the situation and find a diplomatic solution to the situation. But it's clear that we're faced with the Israeli government that has chosen violence over peaceful ways of dealing with disputes, because clearly they want to put their country on a continual path of war to put off the risks that prevails in their internal political dynamics.
That's the Lebanese ambassador speaking to Matt earlier on 5 Live. Well, all this comes, if you've been listening to the news, you'll know this, after more than 30 people were killed in a series of exploding device attacks on Hezbollah members earlier this week. They were widely blamed on Israel. And Hassan Nasrallah, the Iran-backed leader of the group, vowed to inflict retribution in a speech that he gave yesterday.
And earlier this morning, the Lebanese economy minister told the BBC the situation in his country is escalating by the hour and is threatening to spiral out of control. Amin Salam said the days of explosions and airstrikes had bred a cycle of retaliation.
what we were trying to do as a government to quiet things down, calm things down, and try to get to a peaceful platform was really escalated by this last action that was taken by Israel towards Lebanon. So it makes it more difficult that whenever there's an escalation, a negative one, the result is actually always a response that is more aggressive. And that's the cycle we're trying to get out of.
Well, Hanin Gadar is a senior fellow at the Washington Institute and the author of the book Hezbollah Land and joins us now. Hanin, hello. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
We spoke a few days ago, actually. So we are where we are now today with the further attack on the Hezbollah leader or commander. What's your assessment of how the situation has developed?
Well, the situation is definitely escalating by the hour. Obviously, it's no longer a calculated war. And the thing is that today we saw that not only that Israel has infiltrated Hezbollah's deeply into their systems, into their gears, into their leadership, they decided that to escalate because Hezbollah is deterred. Throughout the war, Hezbollah has lost so much and Hezbollah cannot really I think what happened in this conflict, Hezbollah realized that Israel has the upper hand when it comes to technological advancement, intelligence, weaponry, appetite for war. So this is a more of a deterrence for Hezbollah. However, they still feel that they're not going to surrender, and they are doubling down when it comes to the north of Israel as their main achievement of this conflict. However, the problem here is there are three issues that they have to figure out after what happened this week. One is how to establish their communication system. Either they have to go back to cell phones, which will expose them further to Israeli intelligence, or they have to figure out a more primitive way, which will hinder their military operations. Without a proper and efficient communication system, they really cannot talk to each other. And today, what happened with the assassination, and it's not just Aqil who was assassinated. It seems that the deputy of the Quds force in the region, Mohammad Riza, has also been assassinated. I don't think he was the target, but it was a meeting for the Radwan forces, the elite forces of Hezbollah, and the Iranians were there, of course. So we don't know exactly who else was killed in this, but this is a big hit. So if you look at the chart of commandment of Hezbollah when it comes to elite military commanders, there's only one left. So all the top level commanders, you're talking from before, of course, you know, during Syria, they lost a lot. But in this war, they lost between Fuad Shukr and Aqil today. There's only one left who is only in charge of the south, not really of the whole military structure of Hezbollah. So without a proper commandment structure, without a communication network, Hezbollah not only is deterred, they really cannot respond. They can only respond by firing some rockets, Katyusha rockets here and there.
Yeah.
But if Israel today decides to go for war, if Israel today makes a decision to do either land incursion or widen the scale of its targets, like we see today, they're going to do more of this. Hezbollah's response is going to be weak until they figure out how to recover from all these setbacks.
Well,
they cannot.
Yeah, I get that. Just in the past few moments, actually, it's been widely reported in the past hour that Ibrahim Aqil was killed. Reuters are saying in the past few moments, I mean, that Israel has now admitted that he's been killed. So that's only Reuters. We can't confirm that independently. But on all those points you've just made, though, about the provocations on either side, we're told that neither side wants a major conflict. However, our security correspondent, Frank Garden, was really interesting the other day because he said these pager attacks, walkie-talkie attacks, and this consequent attack on the Hezbollah leader today, if they were a precursor for an invasion or a war, why has that not happened? So why these, if you forgive the expression, death by a thousand cuts, what is Israel trying to achieve here, do you think?
Israel is trying to push Hezbollah to stop its attacks on the north. Hezbollah has linked Lebanon to the war in Gaza. And Nasrallah said 2 days ago that he's not going to actually stop until there's a ceasefire in Gaza. The only diplomatic solution for Hezbollah is a ceasefire in Gaza. Israel wants to de-link this. They want Hezbollah to stop no matter what happens in Gaza. So this is an Israeli pressure to push Hezbollah to stop, in the sense they want Hezbollah to ask themselves again that, is the North really worth it? And so far, it hasn't been all these losses were for Hezbollah are still worth it. The North is still worth it. But the problem is that for Israel to do more, they feel that they're doing this effectively. But doing more, like a land incursion or an actually full-scale war, might be much more challenging and damaging for Israel, because you have to do, when you go into war the way you did in Gaza, you have to specify the goals and you have to guarantee them. And there's no guarantee in Lebanon. And Lebanon, war with Hezbollah in Lebanon is not really going to be limited to Lebanon, because Hezbollah's role has changed drastically since 2006. Today, they are the Quds Force regional arm. So they are in Iraq, in Syria, in Yemen, everywhere. So it is really a regional war. It's not a Lebanese war. And this is something that Israel probably cannot do with the U.S., and the U.S. still resisting that kind of war. So they're going to probably escalate in the sense widening the scale of targets, probably hitting more military assets and commanders, until Hezbollah realizes that the North maybe is not that worth it.
Wow.
But that's, of course, an Iran's decision as well. It's not a Hezbollah decision. And Iran doesn't really mind that kind of sacrifice.
No. Look, none of us really know how it will play out, Hanin, and I'm sure we'll speak again soon. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Hanin Gelar there from the Washington Institute. And again, Reuters are saying now that President Biden has said he's going to allow, or he's working to allow, people in northern Israel to return to their homes, those 60,000 displaced people. But also, he says, people in southern Lebanon as well. He's doing his best to get those people rehomed as well. So you're up to date on that conflict. It's 10 to 5 on Drive.
It is. And as always, we love compiling playlists here on Drive, particularly on a Friday. In just a few moments, we'll be finding out how precisely that can help with the fight against dementia as well, as well as being useful for the occasional kitchen disco, kitchen, bedroom, wherever you want to have your party.
Yep. Frank's going to join us. Frank and Alison, they're friends of the show. Frank has dementia, and we're going to play his favourite song for him, as or to him, and for him as well. So that'll be good. But we'd love to know your songs as well. I mean, it can be a song that just evokes a memory, but ideally, if there's someone in your family who is struggling at the moment, and you play this song to them to help them relive times that they can remember actively, that'd be lovely if we could play a bit on air, wouldn't it, I think?
Lovely.
Jeanette?
Definitely.
So the number to that is 85058 or WhatsApp us 0808599693. Brasso Dave's still coming on the show. He's brassoing a stately home with his wife.
So he's, what was his wife's nickname again?
Classy Scrubber Rosemary.
Classy Scrubber.
She's all over the place with a duster.
So we're asking nicknames. Nicknames are associated to your job or your hobby.
Hobbies,
right?
Hobby nicknames. Penny Van Dan's been on.
Penny Van Dan.
Thank goodness I've read all this. Penny Van Dan. Dan's been trying to record 365 climbs of Penny Fan in a year. He says, not the best idea for a 61-year-old balding bloke, but it's for Bowel Cancer UK. And he starts in April next year. So hello to Penny Fan Dan.
I like this. Matt from Northumberland's been on as well. Not quite a hobby, although I do love my job. I'm called Postman Matt with a black and white hat. Very good. I had a postman called Pat. And whenever
you
I
did.
Tell people, yeah, I did. And whenever I tell people, they didn't believe me. But my postman was called Pat for a very long time.
Him?
No, I didn't sing it to me.
Why not? Matt Mann. Hello, Matt Mann. That's
hey, Matt.
John supplies tourist information maps around Cornwall.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good. Thank you for that. Your hobby nicknames keep coming in 85058. And if you do play a tune to a family member to relive memories, we'd love to hear from that. Just a quick reminder, fact of the day is on the way. Big weekend in the Premier League. John Murray's here to preview all that. Arsenal playing Man City, amongst other things. Right, 4:52.
BBC Radio 5 Live, the voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
5 Live Drive.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
As we were just saying, we've covered people's experiences with dementia many times here on Drive. And today is National Playlist Day, and that's organised by the charity Playlist for Life. The idea is to celebrate the power of music to unlock memories, with research showing music can really help people with dementia connect with their past. Former Manchester United manager Sir Alex Ferguson, he's teamed up with the charity, and he spoke to Nina Warhurst on BBC Breakfast this morning about his worries about dementia, as well as his work away from sport. And she started started by asking him how he's doing.
Good, yeah. Retired 11 years now, so you find a way of adjusting, you know.
Keeping yourself out of trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
Missing the management or not really anymore?
Yeah, miss it sometimes. Yeah. I think when my first year after I retired, we were in the European final, and I says to Cathy, I says, this is what I miss, big games, the European games. And so I go to most of the European finals because I find something that I can relate to, you know, what I'd like to have done every day.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
So you can watch them as an observer now and not...
Yeah, exactly.
Outside.
Yeah.
You're here today then to talk about National Playlist Day. So this is encouraging all of us, whatever stage of life we're at, to pick the tracks that sort of run a thread through our history. And then if dementia comes our way, they're there as a sort of grounding for us. What is it about dementia that you think's important?
Well, I think it's a present day's a challenge for all of us, you know, and I've not got a great knowledge about the whole operation of dementia, obviously, but I think we know someone's, you know, Costas has got dementia, and that's a present day challenge, you know. Mm.
Most of us will know somebody or a family living with it.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And when you look at the impact on some of the United legends, Bobby Charlton, Dennis Law, Nobby Styles, can you reflect on how it affected them as men?
You know, I think the main bearing on that is their family. I think we're outside the door of it all. I mean, I was a great friend of Bobby, a great friend of Dennis Law. Mm-hmm. Nobby worked for me. You know, he was one of my coaches. So therefore, when you're confronted with the knowledge of it, you know, what can I do, you know?
It takes its toll on the relatives, doesn't
it? It takes its toll, right? Yeah.
That is Sir Alex Ferguson speaking to Nina Warhurst, who sat on the drive seat alongside me before. Now, what a great idea that we draw up a playlist that if we struggle later in life, then people know what to play. They're not guessing. They know what will bring back those memories. It's brilliant. On the show a lot, Jeanette. I'm not sure you've been on when we've been talking to, but I'm going to introduce you now. Frank Littleford has joined us on the show so often with his wife, Alison. Frank was diagnosed in 2020 and they've been campaigning for better awareness of the condition. Alison is with us now. Alison, hi.
Hello there. Hi. Thank you very much.
Yeah, welcome back aboard. Can I introduce you to Jeanette, who's presenting with me today?
Hello.
She's lovely, Jeanette. Yeah. Alison, meet Jeanette.
Hello, Alison.
Hi. Can you say hello?
Hello, Jeanette.
Hello.
He's
how
there.
You doing?
I didn't think he was there. I can't. Normally, I've got them in vision, so that's great. Hello, Frank.
Hiya, how are you doing?
I'm all right. Didn't think you were there. That's lovely that you're both there. That's great. How are things at the moment, guys?
Not too bad.
Frank, since the last time we spoke with you, there has been a deterioration in Frank's condition.
Right.
So he's finding life more and more challenging, finding it more and more difficult to perform everyday tasks and sometimes struggling to find his way around the house. So, yeah, it's getting more challenging.
That is really sad to hear, Alison. Do you, when you're communicating with Frank, you'll have all your shorthand and everything after all the time you've been together. But do you use music? Or do you think that will become more important as time goes on?
Music has always been a huge part of our lives, and especially Frank, because when he was in his early 20s, he was in a reasonably successful local band in Wolverhampton. And he just loves music. He loves all sorts of music, especially pop music, music from the 60s and 70s and current music as well. So it is a really helpful medium that helps Frank to connect to the past and helps him to remember things that perhaps otherwise he wouldn't be able to recall.
Alison, how does that make you feel when you can see Frank connecting with music like that? How does that make you feel?
It brings me a lot of comfort and peace and joy when I see him listening to a piece of music that relaxes him and just helps him to actually be in the moment when he's listening to that music. It's just wonderful.
We've got a song here that we're going to play, Alice, and you'll know this. I presume you'll know the story behind it because I'm assuming you've chosen it. It's called Every Little Kiss. It might be a bit fruity. I don't know. Is there a story behind this, Bruce Hornsby?
Frank has always been a big, he's always
been a big Hornsby fan. We just missed the start of that, Alice. And what were you saying?
We've both been big Bruce Hornsby fans. Earlier this year, we went to see him in Glasgow and we managed to get him to say hi to Frank, which was really special.
But let's play it out for a bit for Frank. Everyone sees the long day through. Well, what would I do without the nights and the phone and the chance? Alison, I normally have you in vision. I can't see her. Is Frank enjoying that? Is he reacting to that?
I love it. Beautiful.
Frank, I'm talking about you as though you're not there. Have you enjoyed that?
Oh, I love it. Yeah. He can't do any wrong for me. And he spoke to me when we were in
Glasgow.
It was really a dream come true. It sounds like a child, as you know.
Well, he'll be chuffed, Frank and Alison, because you've just got him a few more royalties on the radio, so he'll be happy with that. Alison, we'll talk next time when we've a bit more time. The news is on its way. We've got to go, but I'm sending lots of love to both of you.
The other thing that I just wanted to say, that since we spoke to you, we've been made ambassadors of Alzheimer's Research UK, which is just fantastic, so we're carrying on the work.
Hang on, I'm going to come back and talk to you at the other side of the news. Just bear with me about that. I want to talk to you about that. We can't stop for the news. Hang on one sec. We'll be back with you very shortly. Cheers. Back with Alison and
the
Frank.
Voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Yes, as Tony said, we will be back with Alison and Frank, but let me give you the latest headlines. Mohamed Al-Fayed was a monster whose behaviour was enabled by Harrods, the department store he owned. That's the claim from lawyers who represent some of the 37 women who've accused him of rape and sexual assault. The billionaire died last year, aged 94, and Harrods says it's now a very different company. Our correspondent Azadeh Moshiri has more.
The current owners and Harrods say they're utterly appalled by the allegations, that they apologise to the victims, and that they've set up a process that can quickly settle claims for the women should they want to avoid a lengthy legal process.
Mohamed Al-Fayed also owned Fulham Football Club between 1997 and 2013. It's investigating whether any women were abused there. Israel has carried out what it calls a targeted airstrike on the Lebanese capital, Beirut. 9 people are reported dead, including a senior Hezbollah commander. Almost 60 people were injured. Strikes have increased in recent days after pagers and walkie-talkies used by Hezbollah were blown up. Israel has been blamed but hasn't commented. The police watchdog has apologised for what has been described as abhorrent, degrading and cruel letters it sent to bereaved families and survivors of the Hillsborough disaster. The IOPC says it's extremely sorry for any distress the letters had caused. Val Yates survived the disaster and received one of the letters that she's been speaking to Drive.
They told me that there was no evidence that I'd seen a dead body. I don't know why they brought that into it, because they were scattered all over the pitch. It was one of the most traumatic things I've seen in my entire life. And to tell me that I didn't see it, because there's no evidence to support it, it's just like rubbishing my experiences.
There's been a small rise in the number of people in jail 10 days after around 1,700 prisoners were released early to ease overcrowding. The population of prisons in England and Wales has since gone up by 73, though jails are still below capacity. Nigel Farage has described the last 5 years of government in the UK as a complete breach of trust with the British public. The Reform UK leader has been speaking at